You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base on Earth, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome. So pleased to have you with us. John Kennedy, well, let's see, 1960 was, what, 52 years ago, right now, essentially, gave a speech in which he made this. I'm just going to play this brief comment. He built this whole, you know, all these arguments about we need to do housing and we need to do education and we need to do, you know, we need to care for the weak and the poor among us and all these things. And then he punctuated it with this comment.
Bigger. I believe for these reasons that liberalism is our best and our only hope in the world today.
There you go. That was John Kennedy running for office in 1960, proudly declaring himself as a liberal. When I hear John Kennedy, one of the people I think of is Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. Congresswoman Schakowsky so ably represents the 9th District of Illinois and holds the values, the traditional values of progressives and liberals so well and does such a marvelous job. She is with us live from the DNC. Congresswoman Schakowsky, and I should say her website is schakowsky.house.gov. It's so great to have you back with us. Thanks for joining us.
Tom, I'm so flattered. Thank you. I really appreciate your kind words.
You are genuinely, I mean, I don't say this to, you are genuinely one of the finest people in Congress. So anyhow, let's talk about student loans and rising tuition. This is
sure.
A real crisis right now.
Well, you know, the student loan debt now exceeds all credit card debt, which I find absolutely astonishing, about $1 trillion. And that is such a barrier for our young people to take their rightful place in this 21st century as leaders in our country, because they're so saddled down in debt. And it also limits their choices. It means, you know, can I really go into public service? Is that going to be a career in my life? Can I give back to my community? Can I do Teach for America? I don't know, because I've got this big debt. We do have legislation that would actually make sure that all that debt is not bank debt, but rather the government, you know, that they owe it to the government at lower interest rates, and that it's only for 10 years, and it's only for 10% of your income for 10 years. And if there's still debt remaining, then it would be forgiven. So we have sensible ways to encourage college participation and, you know, make sure the kids get what they need without having lifelong debt.
Yeah, and that's a marvelous first step, and it's one that the Republicans have been blocking for years
right.
and years and years. Don't we need to go a step beyond that, though, and have, you know, the equivalent of a new GI Bill, or do like so many European countries do? I believe that Israel does. I may be wrong on this, but I believe so. If you give a year of service to your country, whether it's in the military or working for nonprofits, in exchange for that, we'll give you free college education, some
you
variation
know, I,
on that.
I agree with that, but I do want to inject a warning here. The GI Bill is being exploited by scammers right now who see this pot of money and are going after veterans as they come back, often young veterans who don't have a lot of experience with borrowing, et cetera, and financial matters. And these can be institutions that do not have, they're really not accredited, have a terrible record of and giving job placement. Institutions where very few of the students actually graduate, but they end up not only with losing the money from their GI Bill, but end up with debt on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
This is not just a couple, but it's a few. It's many of the, not many, but it's enough, too many, of the for-profit institutions that are absolute targeting our GIs. So look out for that, veterans. It's really important.
Yeah, it is. And President Obama did successfully sign legislation stopping some of the payday loan scams that were being hit by that were hitting veterans so hard, didn't he?
Or we did that also manage to make sure that student loan debt on the Stafford loans does not double. The Republicans had to be really dragged into supporting that that legislation, but we finally did get it done before our August recess.
Right. What are your thoughts, Congresswoman Schakowsky, on on you know, the DNC so far, on Bill Clinton's speech last night, on any, you know, pick your choice. What have you heard that's really pushed your buttons, that's gotten really excited?
I have to tell you, you know, sitting on that floor through most of the speeches, I just keep thinking, well, this cannot be topped. There's going to, you know, someone's going to underperform, and yet it hasn't happened at all. I mean, everybody, I believe, that I've heard has exceeded my expectations and given a different message. And the one thing about the messages, the Lilly Ledbetter, the Sandra Fluke, the young mother whose child has a congenital heart ailment, the union members who... and workers who lost their jobs because of Bain. The authenticity of those statements and the resonance they have. Oh, and the dreamers, the dreamer who spoke, leading up to these amazing stars like Michelle Obama and then Bill Clinton. It's just been absolutely extraordinary, in getting, I think, the theme of this Democratic Party and the choices that are to be made, you know, are we all in this together? Are we all in this alone? Am I my brother's keeper? Right. Sister Simone, none on the bus?
Yep.
How amazing was that?
Yep.
So I've just been so proud. Sometimes you think, oh, if only so-and-so would have said this or that, and boy, if I were writing that speech. Well, I haven't felt that one single time this convention. I'm always proud and excited.
My friend Tim Carpenter, who co-founded Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org,
right,
and has done a lot of other things in his life, really great stuff. But anyhow, he sent me an email a couple of days ago, yesterday actually, commenting that it seems that the convention itself is moving the party in a more progressive direction. That the message and the speakers at the convention and the platform, for that matter, are having that effect on, you know, on members of the Democratic Party. Is that your sense?
I absolutely agree with that. You know, from the party, from the platform at our convention, you're hearing an embrace of the term Obamacare and a robust, not just defense, but excitement over what it really means. I loved when Kathleen Sebelius said, "There's only one thing missing from the Ryan and Romney Medicare plan, and that's Medicare."
Yeah.
You know, because right. It really does destroy it as we know it. And then this amazing joyful explanation of what Obamacare really is going to mean for ordinary Americans. Actually, tearful almost, because that young mom saying, what if they repeal it for my little child who has this congenital heart disease? I'll be stuck with lifetime caps,
yeah,
and not get that. You know, so just one issue after another, underscoring how we believe in making it in America, and how Romney is the outsourcer in chief, or the pioneer in outsourcing. I just think the contrast that's been made, but not in a negative and mean and bitter spirit, the kind of thing I heard in Tampa. I went to Tampa, yeah. but really in a sense in a positive and exuberant way.
Yeah. That's marvelous. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, representing Illinois' 9th District, schakowsky.house.gov. Congresswoman, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks so much, Tom.
Keep up the great work, please. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, live from the DNC, right after this. Bill Clinton. I mean, wasn't that great when he said words to the effect of, you know, they, you know, they're, Their sales pitch can be summarized in one quick phrase. Basically, we handed him a terrible mess, and he didn't clean it up fast enough, so fire him and hire us. And it's like, what? That was that. And what's so sad to me, frankly, is that I watched a lot of media this morning, you know, just as we were doing show prep for the show and whatnot, and a lot of television media, which I normally, frankly, don't do, but I just wanted to get everybody's take. And that particular clip, which I thought was the bumper sticker of the speech, never got repeated. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse is on the line with us, a Democrat from Rhode Island, live House, whitehouse.senate.gov is his website, live from the DNC. Senator Whitehouse, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom, and it's great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us again. I'm curious what, first of all, your thoughts on clean energy as the key to global competitiveness. I know this is one of the issues that you really care about.
Yeah, I think we have a real obligation to our economy to make sure that in the international competition for the next generation of clean energy technology, we don't allow ourselves to get left behind by other governments that are investing heavily in this and supporting their private sectors more than we do. We are at risk of being, instead of the innovators and manufacturers of that new generation of technology, to be just sitting here as its consumers, adding to our balance of trade problems and of missing out on the manufacturing possibilities that we could seize if we innovated and manufactured here in the country in this new emerging field.
Well,
and
you know,
it's huge.
It was,
I mean, it's trillions of dollars.
Yeah, it was 1865 was the year that Colonel Drake drilled the first commercial oil well in the United States in Titusville, Pennsylvania. And in the 1870s, I think it was 1877, 78, anyhow, it was during that decade, was the first time that the federal government actually started providing subsidies and tax breaks to the oil industry to encourage it, right? You know, and then some of this came as a result of Mr. Rockefeller's lobbying. And to this day, now, what is it, 150 years later or something like that, we are still giving tax breaks, subsidies, and cash payments to the oil industry, the coal industry, basically the fossil fuel industry. When are we going to step into the 21st century?
We should have done it a long time ago. It is ridiculous to be providing taxpayer-funded subsidies to oil companies while they are making the biggest profits in the history of corporations anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
They are making more money than they know, frankly, what to do with, and yet the taxpayers being asked to chip in and give them even more. It really doesn't make sense. And in the longer term, we have a responsibility to our children, to our grandchildren, to our planet, to get this right. And the longer we depend on polluting fossil fuels, the worse we make it for them. We're at the point now, I think, where 40, 50 years from now, our grandchildren will look back at this generation, and the one issue that they will measure us by more than any other is, were we attentive to this issue when we knew what the problem was, when we knew how serious it was, what did we do? Did we meet our responsibilities? And I'm ashamed to say that right now, the answer would have to be no. And the reason would be the worst of all possible reasons. The reason would be that we were too beholden to special interest money and influence. And so it's really important to get this right.
Right. Brought to you, and that beholdenness brought to you courtesy of the five right-wingers on the U.S. Supreme Court, which brings up the importance of the presidency, because there's probably going to be two, three, maybe more Supreme Court nominations coming up in the next 4 years. I mean, you've got four or five people on the court who are in, you know, well over 70, and at least one of them is not, two of them actually are not in very, very good health. That really highlights the importance of this election. I'm curious.
Yeah, that's a really vital decision. It's also, I think, one of the worst decisions the Supreme Court has ever made. I've heard colleagues compare it to Plessy versus Ferguson.
Yep.
I think it's probably more comparable to Lochner versus
yep.
New York.
Yep.
These are decisions that over time the Supreme Court has corrected. It knew that it made a grievous error and it has corrected itself.
Well,
we need to have that happen on this Supreme Court, and new appointments will be one way to do it. There's no justifying the Citizens United decision.
Yeah, my favorite analogy, actually, is to Dred Scott, because in Dred Scott, the court ruled that people are property.
Yeah.
And in Citizens United, the court ruled the property is people.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just the mirror image of Dred Scott in some ways. In any case, I'm sure you watched the Republican National Convention.
Bits of it.
Yeah, okay, and so did I. I mean, I didn't see the whole thing. I saw, you know, a couple hours every night. And I've been watching the DNC, and you're there. It seemed to me at the RNC that most of the people giving speeches were promoting themselves. They were talking about how wonderful they were, almost like they were auditioning for 2016. And it's been very clear that every single person speaking at the DNC has been talking about President Obama and the importance of reelecting him. Is this convention... really that focused on that? Are people genuinely excited about reelecting President Obama?
I think very much, and I think that the last few evenings of speeches have really hammered that home. I think that Michelle Obama's description of her husband's values and the personal reasons that he holds those values, how his experience has shaped him to hold those values, really set a wonderful tone. It was a great speech, very well delivered, and as my daughter pointed out, she looked fabulous too.
Yeah.
And then along comes President Clinton, and last night the home run he hit, I mean, that ball is still flying. He really did a wonderful, wonderful job at taking a look at the Republican message that they propagated in Tampa and taking it apart, showing how it was either outright false or stood on false premises. And one of the great things about this convention, I think, is that there's been a lot of truth-telling and not a lot of propagandizing.
I think
now we've got the chance for the president to hit his own home run tonight, looking forward to his vision for the future and of this country.
There you go. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOS.
Sorry, that guy always comes in and stuffs on me. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, thanks so much for being with us, sir.
You're very welcome, Tom. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
The Republican argument against the president re-election was actually pretty simple, pretty snappy. It went something like this. We left him a total mess. He hadn't cleaned it up fast enough, so fire him and put us back in.
Welcome back to Talk Media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman radio program, television program on Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, radio stations from coast to coast, satellite, Sirius XM, all kinds of stuff. Welcome back. And with us, Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education in the Obama administration, member of the Obama cabinet. Secretary Duncan, welcome to our program.
Hey, thanks so much for the opportunity, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. There is so much debate, discussion, fireworks, frankly, around the subject of education in the United States right now. From this movie that is apparently funded by, forgetting his name, the right-wing billionaire, this movie that's playing nearby there, and he funded also Waiting for Superman, Aronson or something like that. In any case, all these things, you know, school choice, this kind of stuff. What is the state of education in the United States, and how is the and beyond that, you know, what is the president doing to try to improve education in the United States, or what are you doing?
The president and I just feel this huge sense of urgency that we have to get better faster than ever before. There's never one easy answer. We always talk about a cradle-to-career agenda. We're investing very, very heavily in great early childhood education programs. That's probably the best investment we can make. We're driving a very strong K-12 reform agenda. We want our high school graduates to be college and career ready. We have to reduce dropout rates. And ultimately, we have to make sure that college continues to be accessible and affordable. And I worry a lot about the cost of college. The president has put unprecedented resources behind education. And obviously, there are many areas of contrast between him and his opponent. But maybe there may be no greater area than around education. We fundamentally think of education as an investment, the best investment we can make. They think of education as an expense, something that can be cut. And we will never accept that.
Yeah. I'm old enough to remember I was in the second grade when Sputnik went over, and Dwight Eisenhower just poured a ton of money into the public schools. And in fact, myself and another friend of mine were pulled out of regular classes and put in this advanced program that I ended up getting the scholarship to MSU when I was 14.
Wow.
And this was this massive commitment that was made by a Republican administration.
Yeah.
And then followed on by Jack Kennedy, by the Kennedy administration, and then it kind of died in the, during the Nixon administration as a result of the cost of the Vietnam War. But we had public schools that were extraordinary back, you know, during that time. And I think it would be safe to argue strongly that much of the modern middle class as we know it was the consequence of the GI Bill
that
my dad
right.
went to college on.
That's exactly right.
And shouldn't we be learning some lessons from that era?
No question. And the path to the middle class goes straight through our nation's classrooms. We have to educate our way to a better economy. So we have to make sure every single public school is a great school, a school of choice, that parents can be proud to send their children to, and the community can be proud to support. We have to make sure college continues to be accessible and affordable. One of the accomplishments I'm most proud of was an additional $40 billion for Pell Grants. We got that not by going back to taxpayers. We didn't ask for another nickel. We simply stopped subsidizing banks, put all that money into education. And just this year, we're helping almost 10 million young people go to college using those Pell Grants. So we have to continue to invest. It's actually the biggest influx, Tom, since the GI Bill. But if we don't educate our way to a better economy, other countries are simply going to outcompete us long term. And so we're fighting not just for our children, we're fighting for our country's economic future here.
Right. And the Romney-Ryan perspective on this, basically, you know, Mitt Romney was asked a while ago, how do I start a business? And he said, well, just borrow some money from your father. He had loaned $10 million to one of his sons to start a business. That doesn't work for all of us. My dad was a tool and die maker. I couldn't borrow money from him.
We're not quite that lucky. And I think it just shows, again, fundamentally not understanding, being so distant from the realities. And I can't tell you, Tom, how many not just disadvantaged communities I've visited, but middle-class communities where people are really, really struggling, trying to figure out how are we going to pay for college. And so we are thrilled to invest $40 billion in Pell Grants. We are thrilled to keep Stafford interest rates from going up. But all of us have to continue to invest. Us at the federal level, states have to continue to invest, and universities have to keep their own tuition down as well. I visited Iowa recently, was talking to a young girl, happened to be a senior. She said right now, she's a twin brother at home, right now their dinner time conversation is which twin should go to college, her or her brother.
Oh my.
No family should be having to make those kinds of heartbreaking decisions. That's simply not good enough. That's not who we are as Americans.
Yeah. One of the problems that we've seen with our healthcare system is the profit motive, particularly in the insurance industry, it corrupts. You know, I mean, if your commitment as an institution is to make a profit, number first and foremost, and then secondarily to provide a service, you know, healthcare, something like that, we've seen that, you know, pretty unmistakably. We're now seeing it in education, particularly in these for-profit colleges that are popping up to exploit GIs coming back, you know, with money from the GI Bill. And, you know, a number of scams out there and a number of colleges that are just, you know, leaving these kids high and dry and deeply in debt. Isn't it time for us to start pulling back from the whole concept of for-profit education?
Well, we've worked very, very hard on this issue, Tom, and it's actually a range of players. There are some for-profits that do a good job of getting folks real skills that are leading to real jobs, and we think that's a healthy thing. However, there were far too many who were taking disadvantaged people, taking a huge influx of taxpayers' resources, and then leaving those people in a worse financial situation than when they started. It's just absolutely morally reprehensible. So we pushed very, very hard, put in place some regulations called gainful employment, where we're going to be evaluating everyone across the board. And where there are good outcomes, where people are getting good-paying jobs, that's a good thing. We're happy to support it. But where folks are taking advantage of people trying to climb the economic ladder and actually pushing them further down, we simply don't think taxpayer dollars should go to those places.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, you know, for 30 years, I've been on the board of directors of a nonprofit school in New Hampshire. It's called Hunter School. And for learning disabled kids. And we have never had a board meeting, and we're all unpaid board members.
Yeah.
We've never had a board meeting where we sat around and said, how much money are we making?
Right.
You know, it's always been, how are the kids doing? And I just, you know, I just can't imagine running that institution as a for-profit institution. It just boggles my mind. What do you see as the we have $1 trillion now of student debt. in the United States. It's equal to our credit card debt. It's something that no other generation of Americans has ever seen. Thomas Jefferson's proudest accomplishment, he put it on his tombstone, which he himself wrote, instead of the fact that he was president of the United States for two terms, was the creation of a free university, the University of Virginia. Abraham Lincoln famously created the land-grant college system, including Michigan State, where I went briefly. But, we have a long history of free education. We had an incredible educational system in California before Ronald Reagan was governor. He tore that apart. At what point do we say this is insane? We have never, ever in the history of this country had $1 trillion worth of student loan debt. Yeah. We shouldn't now.
I couldn't agree more. And I always talk about shared responsibility. So the president and I have tried to walk the walk and lead by example. Obviously, very tough economic times where he is flatlining or reducing much of domestic spending. We've had historic increases, I talked about, in Pell Grants. We were able to keep Stafford interest rates from doubling so the problem didn't get even worse. We put in place something called pay as you earn so the young people graduating, if they're making more money, they pay more back. In terms of their debt, if they're making less money, they pay less back. And what's really important in this new regulation, Tom, is that after 10 years of public service, 10 years of being a teacher or working in a nonprofit or working for government, all that debt is going to be forgiven, is erased now, so we can bring that great talent in. So we are absolutely trying to lead by example.
Have you passed that? Is that
in
law?
That is passed. That's called income-based repayment. You can find it on our website, studentaid.gov. And encourage your viewers, your listeners, to come and check us out. But to be clear, Tom, we're thrilled with the progress, but we can't do it by ourselves. States have to continue to invest. 40 states last year cut funding to higher education, Republican and Democrat. And when I meet with the governors every year, I challenge them very hard on that. And universities themselves have to do a better job of being efficient, keeping their tuition down in these tough economic times, and being more creative with using things like technology as well.
And yet at the same time, if you look at the OECD nations, the 34, I think it is, the majority of them offer free college education to their students. In some cases, they require a year of public service, you know, of military service or working in nonprofits in exchange for that or other things. But basically, an education is free or so close to cheap that it is functionally free. We did our show for a week from Denmark. Not only is college free there, they pay you, they give you a couple hundred bucks a month as a stipend for your expenses.
Yeah.
And they're way ahead of us. Is there any discussion of doing something like that in the United States?
I would love to create that kind of opportunity. How we get there is a tough path these days with so many folks in Congress who look at education as an expense rather than the true investment it is.
Yeah.
But, Tom, my wife's from Australia. She experienced a very similar situation, went to a great university, paid almost nothing for it, and because the nation sees this as an investment in itself.
Yeah.
And so I think, as a country, I think that the contrast here, the choice is so clear. Is education an investment, which is what we firmly believe in our bones and in our heart, or is it an expense that can be cut? And that's what the other side thinks.
Yeah, tragically. We're talking with Secretary Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education in the Obama administration, BarackObama.com, of course, the website. Secretary Duncan, thank you so much for joining us today and for your candid responses to some of the what might have been rather tough questions. Thank you for joining us.
No, thanks so much for the opportunity. Have a great day now.
I appreciate it. Good talking with you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, one of the progressive champions of the United States Senate, Senator Jeff Merkley, will be with us live from the DNC. Place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program, and Senator Jeff Merkley, the U.S. Senator, the junior senator from Oregon, on the line with us. Merkley.senate.gov is his website. Senator Merkley, great to have you back on our program.
Oh, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you.
You are one of the genuine progressive voices in the United States Senate, and I just want to tell you how much I honor that and respect that and how pleased I am that you represent, in a way you represent. I still own a home in Oregon, so I guess you still represent me, even though I'm living here in D.C. most of the time. And we're just so glad to have you with us. Tell us about the jobs bill that President Obama has you know, put forward that the Republicans are obstructing, and what can we do about jobs in the United States?
Well, the key piece of having there's multiple pieces related to infrastructure, related to putting folks back to work with our public sector around the country. But the key is that right now, Mitch McConnell abuse of the filibuster is meaning that we can't get dialogue and decisions out of the U.S. Senate. The Senate cannot operate as a legislative body. And it's why next January I'm going to be immersed in carrying this fight again to change the rules of the Senate.
To end the filibuster?
Yes. Well, not completely end it, but to change it to a talking filibuster,
uh-huh,
where you have two ways to shut it down. Right now, it's one senator objects and you end up with basically you have to get the majority has to get a supermajority to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
But in the situation with the talking filibuster, you have a second path where the moment somebody isn't available to speak to the bill, you go to a final vote. So that now the minority who wants to block the process has to be visible before the American public. And thus, for example, in the Disclose Act, if my Republican colleagues were there day and night trying to defend vast secret pools of money, we would soon get a public reaction that would allow us to pass it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We're talking with U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Senator, the Farm Bill. Tell me about this. You played a role in this?
Yes, I certainly did. I have several pieces in there, including a piece that I did in partnership with Dick Lugar that is related to the construction industry. It seems a little funny to have in the Farm Bill, but it is a piece that is for rural electrical co-ops to offer low-cost loans for energy-saving retrofits on both commercial buildings and homes. And it's considered the single most cost-effective way to create living wage jobs.
Wow, that's extraordinary. And it's now in law.
It's not in law because the Farm Bill hasn't been passed through the House.
Ah.
And in fact, in Oregon right now, we have our grasslands are burning, our forests are burning. We have an area the size of Rhode Island, the largest, basically the largest fire in a century. And the emergency provisions that would normally help the ranchers and those who own forest lands are tied up. They're not authorized because the House hasn't acted on the Farm Bill.
Oh, my. Is this an intentional thing by the House Republicans? Is this part of their plan to blow up anything that Obama does that's good?
Anything that would show momentum that finally things are getting done to put America back on track. It's so unacceptable.
It's so un-American.
For folks to come to D.C. as elected representatives and say our goal is to prevent problem solving at all costs, it's just wrong, and there has to be a pushback from the American public.
Yeah, this group of congressmen and senators who met on the night that Barack Obama was inaugurated at the Caucus Room restaurant, which was right around the corner from where Louise and I used to live, D and 8th Street. And it was a D and 9th, and just basically swore a blood oath to block anything that President Obama wanted to do for the next 4 years. And they've kept that commitment. And Paul Ryan was a member of that meeting. It's just extraordinary. What are your thoughts on the convention? How's that going? What's your sense of it?
It's going so well. It's going so well. Michelle Obama spoke to our hearts across America and laying out the challenges that her family went through and her husband's families went through. It's such a different background than Romney's. I mean, they understand firsthand the challenges of a working family in America. And when she said that our vision is that when you get through the door of opportunity, you don't slam it shut. In fact, you reach back and you hold it open for others to go through. That is what America is. That's why so many of us are in public life, that we want to see all families succeed. We are not about, in the Democratic Party, we are not about the 1% getting richer and more powerful and controlling more of the resources. We're for every family to succeed. And that is just a fundamental difference that was so apparent. And last night, Bill Clinton took apart the Republican analysis, and he did it in a fashion that I thought wasn't full of hate, wasn't full of cynicism. It was just saying these are the facts, the way they work. And I thought he did a superb job of laying out the case.
He filleted them like a sushi chef with a smile on his face.
Yes.
It's extraordinary.
Yes, indeed.
It was just extraordinary. I noticed at the Republican National Convention, it seemed like most of the speeches were about me, you know, about the individual speaker. They were telling their own stories. almost like they were auditioning for 2016. There was very little discussion of Mitt Romney and why he should be president, and virtually no discussion of policy other than trashing President Obama. Here at the Democratic Convention, it seems to me that every single speaker has been talking about real policy, real programs, things that the Obama administration has done, and fully embracing our president of the United States. Have you noticed that difference, or am I just, this is my bias?
Well,
showing.
I have, and what I've really noticed is that we're so comfortable at this convention arguing for the policies we've put forward because we believe in them and it's analysis behind them. But our Republican folks at their convention, they were trying to just basically assert the opposite of the truth in order to make their case because they didn't have this story right. It's like on Medicare, where Republicans are always talking about efficiency. Well, Democrats came in and said there are a bunch of Medicaid Advantage plans that aren't performing. There are ones that are, and those that aren't performing are going to be held accountable. And the savings is going to be invested in other aspects of Medicare for the benefit of our seniors.
Right.
And, the Republicans came in and said, well, you took the money and you put it somewhere else. Well, it's just actually factually wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. The fact checkers were so busy during the Republican convention because there were so many lies flying around. It hasn't been so much at the Democratic convention.
Full employment for folks who want to know the truth.
There you go. Senator Jeff Merkley, ably and brilliantly representing the great state of Oregon. Senator, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Great talking.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Lee Saunders on the line with us. He's the president of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. If I have that right, President Saunders, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
So tell us what AFSCME's up to.
Well, we're here in Charlotte, and we're going to be organizing our members and mobilizing and educating our folks because this election is so extremely important. I think everyone who listened to the nonsense that was coming out and the rhetoric that was coming out of the Republican convention last week should understand that this is extremely important. It's extremely important to get the vote out. It's extremely important to mobilize our communities because there is a clear, very clear difference between what the Republicans are talking about and what the Democrats are talking about, whether it's saving Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid or protecting workers' rights and civil rights and women's rights, moving this country forward or taking it many, many steps backwards. And I think that choice is clear, and we're going to be working like never before to mobilize our communities to support Barack Obama for his reelection effort.
Now, as the guy who is the president of the union that represents government employees, you guys have really been taking it on the chin from the Republicans here for the last couple of years, actually for the last 30 years, arguably. But in particular, I mean, this demonization of government employees that has been the mantra of people like John Kasich and Scott Walker and the other they've become icons now in the Republican Party. How are you responding to that?
Well, I mean, in Wisconsin, as you know, we attempted to recall the governor. We didn't make it. It was a setback, but we're still organizing our folks, and we're still going to be strong advocates for public service in that state, and we're going to win ultimately in that state. We were able to protect the Senate in that recall by flipping the Senate, and now it's in Democratic control, and we've got to keep it in Democratic control. We took out a number of other senators who supported Walker and when he stole collective bargaining away from us. It's all about organizing your communities, not only our members, but our allies and our partners across the country. I mean, we had a similar problem in Ohio where John Kasich wanted to do the same thing that Scott Walker did, but you can't recall in Ohio, so we had an initiative process. And we were able to put that on the ballot in last November. We let the citizens of Ohio decide whether public service workers should have the right to collectively bargain. We won by more than a 2-1 margin. That just shows you what we can do when we put our minds to it, when we organize our members and our communities. And that's exactly what we're going to be doing from now until November, because the choice is so stark. Last time around in 2008, we had 40,000 boots on the ground. We're going to have 80,000 boots on the ground all over the country in battleground states for this election. And we're going to be engaged like never before, not only knocking on our doors, our members' doors, and making phone calls and leafleting, but we're going to be knocking on the doors of non-union members and telling them the importance and talking about the importance of this election and educating them, as President Clinton educated the Americans who were looking at his speech last night. I mean, I thought that was a great speech, and he really laid out the differences between what's being proposed by Romney and Ryan and the record of Barack Obama, and we're going to support him heavily.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a brilliant speech. You are so right. In Michigan, 700,000 working people in Michigan got together, and they've submitted 700,000 petition signatures to put on the ballot a constitutional amendment to add to the Constitution of the state of Michigan the right to collectively bargain. Is AFSCME involved in that?
Yes, we are. As a matter of fact, we sit at the table. We're working very closely with the UAW, who initiated this referendum, and we're going to be getting our folks out to support that. We also have another initiative in that state, where right now the governor, there was legislation passed last year, I guess, where the governor has the ability to declare a financial emergency in any governmental jurisdiction within the state of Michigan, and he can put his cronies in.
Yep.
Wipe out the elected officials, wipe out the mayor, wipe out the county commissioners, wipe out anyone.
And he's done it.
And
Ben Harbor, Detroit.
Yes, he has. He puts his cronies in, and they can abrogate the contracts that have been negotiated by the unions. It's a local dictator law. That's exactly what we call it.
Yeah.
So that's going to be on the ballot also. We're trying to overturn that because it's undemocratic.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
what's happening. I mean, we've got to look at this very, very seriously. These folks are trying to take our democracy away from us. I mean, they want to continue to reward the 1% by giving them more power, by giving them more wealth at the expense of the 99% who are trying to play by the rules every single day, putting bread on the table, trying to make ends meet, sending their kids to school. So we've got to rise up. The 99% has got to rise up and say, not on our watch, and that's exactly what we're going to do.
Yeah. And what can average Americans do who are not members of unions to support the efforts of AFSCME?
I think they can they should make their voices heard. I mean, this nonsense about us being used as scapegoats when we're your neighbors and we're your friends and we're providing essential public services to communities across this country. You need to stand with us, and we'll stand with you. And that's what we're doing. We're building our coalitions all across this country, and we've got to make our voices heard. So we're asking for help. We're asking for support. And we're asking people to do the right thing to move this country forward, not take it backwards.
Yeah. You guys have a little more, in some ways, difficult and in some ways brilliantly, there's a brilliant opportunity there in the job that you have in selling your union to just the very existence of it. To other, you know, to Americans who may not even really understand unionization. And that is that, you know, I mean, if the UAWs or the Teamsters or somebody are out there talking about, you know, what they do, they're talking about private sector jobs. And you're talking about public sector jobs. You're representing government employees. And so not only do you have to represent the importance of having democracy in the workplace, a union, but you also have to represent the importance of actually having a functioning government that has employees who are doing their jobs and doing so in a way where they feel like they're committed, they have a career, they have benefits that are worthy of staying here over the long term and really putting in well. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, we've got to promote public service and the importance of public service. So often you hear from the noise machine on the Republican side that we don't need government. The government is too big. That it's bloated. That government employees are overpaid. Their benefits are too high. And those are lies. Just like the lies coming out of that convention last week. And we've got to educate the public about the important work that we do. I mean, you know, we represent public service workers all over the country in almost any occupation that you can imagine. And that could include public safety, corrections officers, highway workers, sanitation workers, public health, child care workers, home care workers, librarians, you name it, we've got them. And these folks and these members provide essential public services every single day. And we can't be marginalized, and we can't be demonized. And that's exactly what the other side is trying to do. And we're asking our allies, and we're asking our friends who understand the importance of government, who understand the importance of when there's a crisis, we're the first ones that hit the ground running to deal with that crisis. And we've got to speak up and speak out and speak against the lies that are coming from that noise machine on the Republican side.
Indeed. We're talking with Lee Saunders, the president of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, AFSCME.org, AFSCME.org is the website. I do have the name of the union right.
AFSCME, American
yes, sir.
Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
That's yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, there you go. Lee Saunders, thanks so much for being with us, sir, and for the great work that you and your union are doing. It is God's work. It's important stuff. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We'll be back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We got lots more coming from the DNC, Congressman Kucinich and others, as well as your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day coming up.
Now, people ask me all the time how we got four surplus budgets in a row. What new ideas did we bring to Washington? I always give a one-word answer. Arithmetic.
Yeah, and you know, it boggles my mind. I've been watching a lot of television lately, the last couple of days, you know, during these conventions, and you see these commentators on Fox or on the big networks and whatnot, and they go, oh yeah, Bill Clinton, he had a surplus because he worked with the Republicans. Actually, the Clinton budget that raised taxes on the rich and balanced the budget got no Republican votes in the House of Representatives. Zero. Newt Gingrich stood up on the floor of the House and gave a speech about how it was going to create a Great Depression in America. The Republicans fought it tooth and nail. So, anyhow, just for the record. On the line with us, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, U.S. Congressman representing Ohio's 10th District, kucinich.house.gov. And you've got a new website, Congressman Kucinich. I'm sorry I don't have it written down here in front of me. Tell me about it.
It's kucinichaction.com, and it's our effort to reorganize in 50 states, grassroots level, to help people not just elect the best candidates, but to help people learn how you can successfully win on community issues, even when it looks like you can't. And
okay.
So, you know, that's how I brought my career forward. I want to teach other people how to do the same thing.
And people can learn about that at Kucinich, Kucinich, action.com.
Thank you so much, Tom, and it's good to be with you here from Charlotte.
Well, it's great to have you with us and to hear, you know, from you and what's going on there. Living wage for working people, this is one of the passions of your life. Tell us, you know, what your thoughts are about where we are, where we've been, and where we're going.
There's been a real decline in the earning power of people since 1968. The minimum wage right now is not sufficient to be able, for people to be able to support their families. So what I've been advocating is, along with Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. and Ralph Nader and others, is to come to a living wage, which would approximate $10 an hour, to make sure that people have the ability, particularly with the large employers, to be able to support their families. And let's face it, I mean, we have an economy where things not only cost more, but in relative terms, workers are losing their status. Median income over this period of time has not risen in a way that would cause the American people to believe that they're participating in the recovery that we hear about.
Yeah. Yeah. So where do we go? What do we do?
Well, we need a broad-based economic program, Tom. And, you know, just to sketch it out very quickly, and I don't know if we're going to hear anything about that tonight, we need to get America back to work. We need to rebuild America's infrastructure. There's over $2 trillion in infrastructure needs that are unmet. We have 10 million people unemployed. We match the unemployed with the work to be done. People say, well, where's the money going to come from? The government has to spend the money in the circulation the same way the Fed does, and it has the same power to do it.
Sure.
And we need to get, and that's the base of my NEED Act, the National Employment Emergency Defense Act, which is to enable the government to create the jobs. The private sector is not creating the jobs at the pace that will achieve a recovery. And we can't leave it to them. We can't, and we can't say, well, the government doesn't have a role in this. We should be working on trying to cut the budget. We keep working on cutting the budget. We're going to cut out the ability to recover. We're going to cut out social programs. That's not acceptable. So, you know, and then get out of the wars and change the tax structure. I mean, these are things that are achievable. The president can lead on them. We need a Congress to cooperate. America, I think, is ever ready for a new day. That was what 2008 was about, and frankly, that's still what 2012 was about.
My friend Tim Carpenter, you know Tim, the founder of Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, sent me a note a couple days ago commenting that it looks like, or yesterday, commenting that it looked to him like the Democratic convention, the speakers at the convention, people putting together the platform, but in particular the speakers, are actually moving the party in a more progressive direction, to the left. Is that your observation?
No.
Tell me about that.
Tim and I worked together on founding Progressive Democrats of America.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what he's talking about. I mean, the fact of the matter is, we don't have a jobs program. We're still in Iraq and Afghanistan, plus Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan. I emphatically disagree with the economic and foreign policy of this administration. Now, having said that, when I go into the voting booth, essentially I'm going to have two choices. Now, I know there's others who will say, well, there's other candidates, but the fact of the matter is the next president is going to be either Barack Obama or Mitt Romney.
Right.
And, it's a tough choice for people who feel, well, you know, there might not be a difference between the two parties. It's not a tough choice for me because I think that even though I would agree with some who say we're not better off today, the fact of the matter is we'll be a hell of a lot worse off if Mitt Romney becomes president of the United States. And I say we, I'm talking about the great mass of American people.
Right.
So, you know, is it the choice do I agree with everything the Obama administration does? Absolutely not. But if I can support Barack Obama, I think any Democrat can.
Yeah, my big thing is the Supreme Court.
I agree.
I mean, it's like, we're going to have three more Scalias appointed to the Supreme Court.
You know what, you're right. We have to, look, you only need to look at Buckley versus Valeo and Citizens United to understand, and the potential for a reversal of Roe v. Wade, to understand how serious the Supreme Court is as the third branch of government. I mean, we have three branches of government. You wouldn't know it. Sometimes Congress doesn't function as an Article I estate. But the fact of the matter is the Supreme Court is gaining more and more power. Their Bush versus Gore or Gore versus Bush decision was a nightmare for America. So since 2000, we've seen the Supreme Court on so many major cases take a position that has taken America in a direction that has been profoundly worse than we are. And, you know, if we want to talk about whether we're better off or not, we have to include Congress in that. It's not like the president is a one-person show here.
Yep.
Congress hasn't done its job. We have to include the Supreme Court, which has been regressive
in
their decisions and undermining our democracy at every step.
Well said. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Congressman Dennis Kucinich, check out KucinichAction.com. Congressman, thanks so much for being with us today.
Tom, let's talk again, and Elizabeth says hello. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
Bye now.
Pass along my regards. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Congressman Gerald Nadler is on the line with us, U.S. Congressman representing the 8th District of the great state of New York. Nadler.house.gov is website. Congressman Nadler, welcome back to our program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Great to have you with us. What's your big takeaway right now from the DNC, from the convention there?
Well, my takeaway is a couple of things. Number one, Michelle Obama just had a fantastic speech and did what she had to do. And President Clinton, he is fantastic. And he just took everything the Republicans were saying and pulverized it. Just absolutely pulverized it and knocked all the lies and the distortions into a cocked hat. And anyone who listened to that speech or reads about it or even hears parts of it again or people quoting it, he made it very understandable why the Democrats, the president did not steal $716 billion from Medicaid, as the Republicans were saying, from Medicare, as the Republicans were saying, why the Republicans are responsible for the huge deficit, why we have a real choice as to how to proceed here. And if we want to get out of the depression, if we want to have more jobs created, if we want to depend on each other and not have only the very rich be okay and everybody else, the devil take the hindmost, you got to vote for Obama. He made it so crystal clear that I have to believe that, unlike Romney, who the polls tell us got no bump from his convention, President Obama, who I expect will deliver a great speech tonight, but regardless of whether he does, President Obama will get a great bump from this convention.
Well, and
because
and,
it's very educational.
Yeah, it's very interesting. One of the headlines on one of the news websites I saw this morning was Romney doubles down on welfare to work claim. The Romney campaign and the and Karl Rove's organization, which is spending hundreds of millions of dollars in television ads, they're continuing to run ads saying that President Obama took money out of Medicare and he's going to hurt your Medicare, and that President Obama, you know, did away with the welfare to work requirement. These things that are clearly lies that Bill Clinton just laid out as lies last night. Do you think that that big lie strategy is going to work?
I think not, unless it's just backed up by so many hundreds of millions of dollars and multiples of what's spent to tell the truth, then it conceivably could work. But I think it's highly unlikely. I think we'll see also whether the press does its job of pointing out when things are just straight untruths. You know, as Pat Moynihan used to say, everyone's entitled to his own opinions, but not to his own facts.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned the difference between the Democratic convention and the Republican convention. It seemed to me that the Republican convention, that most of the passion was hating Obama, and most of the speeches were people talking about themselves and how great they were and how what wonderful things that they'd done with their lives and their careers and their states. And, and by the way, tacked on to the very end, almost as an afterthought, vote for Romney. And, first of all, am I just seeing this through a complete, you know, filter, or do you agree with that characterization? And if so, how would you contrast that to what's going on at the DNC?
Well, you have several characterizations there. I certainly think there was a lot of rhetoric about how I love my mother and I love my father and my wife and my kids and we're a nice family and my grandparents had a hardscrabble existence and I'm the first or second generation who went to college and all of that, all of which maybe I'm sure is true. And President Clinton said, well, grant all that. They love their parents, et cetera. But of how much relevance is that to the problems that we have to solve?
Right.
It doesn't tell us much about what you're going to do about jobs or anything else. Secondly, it is true for a number of those speeches, not all of them, that Romney seemed an afterthought. I mean, Governor Christie was promoting himself for, I suppose, the presidential nomination 4 years from now, and so a number of the other people. And we haven't seen much of that or any of that, as far as I can tell, here. But the other thing was that there were no specifics. The entire Republican convention can be summed up, and the entire Romney campaign, for that matter, in a couple of sentences. Things aren't good. The unemployment is still high. It's the president's fault. Why? Because he's there. I'll fix it. I won't tell you what I'll do to fix it. I won't tell you what he hasn't done right to fix it. I've got this magical solution, which I won't share with you. And vote for me because I showed at Bain that I know how to create jobs.
You know, Richard Nixon actually won an election on that, you know, on his secret plan to end the war in Vietnam.
Yes, he did. But I think that Hubert Humphrey wasn't willing to state what he would do,
yeah,
which is not the case this year.
Well, LBJ had actually negotiated a peace, and the Nixon campaign went in there and sabotaged that. And we've just learned that in the last year that they've released those tapes of LBJ talking to Everett Dirksen and saying, you know, we got the CIA wiretaps on this, and this is treason, Everett. And Everett Dirksen saying, yes, it is treason, and I'll try to get Richard Nixon to stop it. And he didn't. He was unsuccessful. And LBJ took that secret to his grave, but we digress. We're talking with Congressman.
But that treason cost the lives of another 20 or 25,000 American troops.
You're absolutely right.
And we should not make light of it.
Yes, no, we shouldn't, and we should never forget it either. I play that tape of LBJ talking to Dirksen frequently on this program. It's just incredible. And so what are the policy things? You pointed out that the Republican convention was short on policy. The Democratic convention, it's been policy all over the place. What are the things that are really pulling your chain? What are the things that are really getting you excited?
Well, a lot of things are getting me excited, in particular that we have a number of choices here. Do we do something to break what's been going on for a long time now, namely that wealth is increasingly concentrated in very few hands at the top of the ladder, and that the middle class is being shredded, and to talk about that is not class warfare. The fact of the matter is that there are policies. Our tax system aids and abets that. Many things that the government does or doesn't do aids and abets that situation. We have to reform our tax system so that people who are earning millions of dollars are paying more taxes and a higher rate of taxes than their secretaries. That's the least we can do, and the president keeps saying that. And, of course, Romney and Ryan want to do exactly the opposite. If you take their tax plan, then a millionaire will be paying $250,000, or someone who makes $3 million will be paying $250,000 less a year in taxes. And middle-class people, as President Clinton said, middle-class people have about $2,000 more in taxes, or you'll just triple the deficit on an annual basis.
Right.
Secondly, how do we generate jobs? Now, there's only one real way to generate the jobs, and we started doing it. You know, when the president took office, we were losing 780,000 jobs a month. We lost 800,000 in January of 2009. We passed, the Democratic Congress passed, at the president's push, urging the stimulus bill, the American Recovery Act, which provided money for infrastructure and provided money for the state so that they wouldn't lay off cops and firefighters and teachers and wouldn't not hire the private company to fill the potholes, and cut taxes on the middle class and low income people, and they saved the auto industry. And the results of those two things were that within a year he turned it around. Instead of by the beginning of 2010, instead of losing 750,000 jobs a month, we were gaining 250,000 a month. Turned it around by a million jobs a month turnaround. Then the president suggested and said, look, in order to keep this recovery going at an increasing pace, so we're gaining 250,000 and 300,000 jobs a month and start whittling down the unemployment, which is high because of the catastrophe that we inherited, we have to have the American Jobs Act to continue what we started doing. And the Republican Congress said no. And when the Republican Congress, after they were elected, and said no, then you start seeing the jobs increases tailing off. Instead of 250,000, it's 160,000, 130,000, because the Republicans in Congress stopped the president from continuing the policies which were hyping the economy.
Right.
And so the real question before us, are we going to allow a Romney administration or a Republican Congress to stop and to continue stopping the successful policy that was reversing the economic catastrophe, or are we going to let the President Obama, re-elect President Obama, and a Democratic Congress, which will allow that the resumption of that policy, to invest in people, to invest in the country, so that prosperity trickles up, not down. That's the only way you can do it.
Grover Norquist told the Financial Times earlier this week that if the Republicans take the White House and the Senate, that their strategy is going to be to pass every single piece of legislation that they want to get done, even stuff like abortion legislation, via reconciliation. They'll attach it all to budget bills so it'll be passed on a 10-year basis via reconciliation. It can't be filibustered by the Democrats. We have just a minute left here, sir, but I'm curious your thoughts on if the Democrats take the House back and President Obama holds on to the White House, might that be a strategy to get some of these things like the American Jobs Act passed, to make them budget bills rather than, you know, which are not subject to the filibuster, rather than standalone pieces of legislation?
Well, it certainly is a strategy. I would hope that what we would do is eliminate the filibuster in the Senate, but I'm not a senator, so my opinion doesn't count that much. But I would hope we would eliminate the filibuster, but failing, because it's undemocratic in the extreme, but failing that, Yes, we should expand the use of the reconciliation. And remember how solidly the Republicans, how viciously, assailed the use of reconciliation for parts of the American Recovery Act,
right.
For parts of the Medical Act.
The Affordable Care Act. Right?
The Affordable Care Act. And now they're talking about using it for everything. We should do that.
Yeah. That's how they passed the Bush tax cuts, too. They were passed by reconciliation.
Yes. But reconciliation simply, to the extent it eliminates the Senate filibuster, is a legitimate tool for budget bills and for things that affect the budget.
There you go. Congressman Gerald Nadler of New York, thank you so much for being with us, sir.
It's a pleasure.
Great talking with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back with more from the DNC. My thoughts, your calls, the news of the day. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Actor Richard Schiff is in the on the line with us. He played Toby on the TV show The West Wing, where he was the senior advisor to President Bartlett. He's now on the TV show NCIS. He's a volunteer working with the Barack Obama campaign, barackobama.com. Richard Schiff, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I've listened to you for quite a long time and always have been very, very impressed with your intelligence and thorough analysis of things.
Well, thank you so much for your kind words, sir.
You're welcome. I do have to say I'm not an official surrogate in any way. I mean, I've not been coached by the Obama team, so therefore I won't be articulate.
Okay.
No, it's not an official capacity in any way.
Okay, so you're just hanging out and being there as a booster.
Yes. I mean, I'm here promoting a couple of things, but I'm also very happy to hopefully boost the campaign in any way that I can. I'm not sure I'm going to have any effect whatsoever, but it certainly makes me feel better to talk about it.
You want to talk on the air about the things you're there to promote?
Sure. I mean, one is the new political series, believe it or not. Like, I haven't gotten enough of that.
Uh-huh.
Called Chasing the Hill, which is a digital series, a webisode, if you will.
Uh-huh.
Focusing on the re-election campaign of a congresswoman in California in this new Citizens United era, someone who cares a whole bunch about things and has gotten herself into some trouble. And Robin Wiegert from Deadwood plays that character quite brilliantly.
Wow.
And it's all on the like guerrilla filmmaking. You know, we use whatever cameras are available. It's Canon 7s and 5s and 5Ds and 70s and uh-huh. iPhones if necessary.
Yeah.
Natural light, and it's all on the cheap, and it's a pay-per-view kind of deal for a price of a small black coffee.
And you're throwing it up on the web. Where can people find that?
ChasingTheHill.com.
ChasingTheHill. Okay.
ChasingTheHill.com, and they just have to click on episode one or two and enjoy it. We're getting great reaction, great reviews around the world, and it's a labor of love, so it's a lot of fun. I'm not going to have time to continue to be in it. I'm in a couple of episodes, but I'm going off to Broadway to do Glengarry Glen Ross with Al Pacino, so I'll be a little busy.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that's exciting for me.
That is spectacular. I mean, that's serious acting. That's the real stuff.
I got to get serious.
Yeah.
It's time to get serious. I'm working with Mr. Pacino again, yeah.
Yeah, it's very impressive. What are your thoughts about what's going on around you there in Charlotte?
It's, you know, a bit overwhelming. Sometimes I have to remind myself that my lips are moving and a voice is coming out of me because I've been talking so much. I'm always quite impressed, especially at the Democratic conventions, because I've been to both, the sense of community here mm-hmm. and the sense that people are kind of working together in the same boat. There's a camaraderie and there's a friendliness. And, you know, just people being supportive of each other and their efforts to get through the mess here, the traffic and so on. That's the first thing. It just feels good. And then you have things like President Clinton's speech last night, which I was able to get on the floor for. And it was the first time I was ever warm in Vermont. I was sitting in Vermont, and it was warm. Right next to
you were with the Vermont delegation.
I was, yeah, next to Senator Leahy, who is
a stand-up guy,
very stand-up guy, lovely man,
yeah,
and his wife. And I think witnessed what was possibly a historic speech, historic in its ability to communicate clearly And inspire hopefully more than half the country.
Yeah, this guy is Bill Clinton and I did a fundraiser for Congressman Jim McDermott back about 4 years ago.
When he was dropping names again.
Yeah, when Jim McDermott was being sued by Newt Gingrich and he had $300,000 in legal bills, he outed Newt, which is what caused Newt to have to leave the Congress. Newt was breaking federal law.
Right.
And first of all, just standing backstage with him, you know, he just turns that on. It's like, you're the most important person in the world.
Yes.
And then secondly, he walked out there in front of, we had about 3,500 people in the audience, and stood there for 30 or 40 minutes without no notes, nothing.
Yeah.
And just held that audience in the palm of his hand in a way that I had never seen in my life.
Yeah.
And that's what we saw last night. It's just extraordinary.
But on so many levels, just if you just analyze the ability to communicate, and when you're communicating and you want to actually move people to do something, which is no easy feat, there's a certain amount of entertaining that has to be done. There's a certain amount of humor that has to happen. And then ride the humor. You notice how he cut through every laugh that he got?
Mm-hmm.
It's a brilliant way of communicating, because he was saying, yes, let's make a little joke, but that's not what's important. What's important is that he goes, now listen to this. Now listen to this, though.
Yeah.
This is what's important. Which communicated the urgency of what he was saying. But the way he swatted one after the other, the Republican falsehoods that are being perpetrated on the American people right now, was brilliant. I thought it was absolutely brilliant, right on, factual, and impressive.
There's a gestalt or a method or something to what he's doing, and I think it's totally intuitive. I suspect that the most brilliant politicians in our history have all had that.
Yeah, and communicators, whether you're an actor or a politician, and Arthur Miller once wrote this great piece about how they're very closely connected, mm-hmm. because politicians have to be actors. They're presenting a character.
That's why Ronald Reagan did well.
That's why Ronald Reagan did very well, and as you would judge any performer, the more that you think they're speaking the truth, the more you react to them emotionally, the more you forget that they're acting. Mm-hmm. And that's the sense I get from President Clinton, is that he's committed his life to making this world a better place.
Yeah,
and he's committed his life to public service,
and he's using those tools of communication to do it so brilliantly.
And so the information, the analysis, the study, everything is so close to his chest that there is no separation between truth and performance, and that's what makes it brilliant.
Yeah, I absolutely think you've nailed it. Actor Richard Schiff played Toby in the TV show The West Wing, where he was the senior advisor to President Bartlett. You're now on the TV show NCIS, heading off to Broadway. Is there a website for the work that you're doing, Richard?
I have a website, believe it or not, richardschiff.com, which shocks me, but
okay.
It's there.
So check it out. Great.
Okay.
And the project you told us about, tell us that website again.
Chasingthehill.com.
Chasingthehill.com.
Come check it out.
Thank you very much,
Richard. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Tom.
Thank you for dropping by. It's great
pleasure.
Meeting you.
Okay.
Bye.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live in Washington, D.C. and live in Charlotte, North Carolina. Congressman Joe Crowley, representing the 7th District of New York in the United States House of Representatives. Congressman Crowley, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be with you.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
What are you seeing there at the Democratic National Convention? What are you seeing that really gets you excited?
Well, I have to tell you right now, I'm just missing James Taylor singing Carolina in my mind. That's got me excited. But
aside, he was there doing it?
He's just doing it now. But I'd rather be on your show and talk about being here. Let me, you know, Tom, I got asked a similar question the other day by a local outlet up in New York. And the word happy comes to mind. People here are just happy. There's a lot of happiness. And it sounds sophomoric, but it really is. I think there's such a positive feeling here about what's happened at this convention. People have asked me, do you think that the convention has run its course? Is it a thing of the past? And I think to some degree, as much as maybe some would suggest that the, you know, our party has downplayed the convention. I think there's a potential here for a good boost coming out of this this convention for the president. Yeah. I think all the speeches that have gone on so far, Michelle Obama, certainly President Clinton last night, making the case for the president's reelection, that's been made for him, and I think we're just all really anticipating a wonderful speech tonight by the president.
Yeah. Last night on Fox, Charles Krauthammer was talking about how the reason why the president is going to be speaking inside the arena tonight rather than in a stadium was because, you know, they've known, you guys have known for months that the weather was going to be just fine today. There was going to be no rain at all.
Huh.
And that therefore it had to be that they just couldn't get enough people to fill the stadium, sort of like Ford Field, I guess, where Mitt Romney famously took a stadium and to speak to about maybe 1,000 people. What's the weather like there?
You know, as a matter of fact, it rained on my way into the building today. It's a little sunny now, but it's very cloudy out. And, you know, the reality is maybe this president thinks more about his supporters than the Republicans do. You know, doesn't want them sitting out there in the rain. I think they would have stayed. They had more people who wanted to be in the arena, in the stadium, than they could accommodate. Mm-hmm. And I feel very bad for the tens of thousands of people who made their way to Charlotte to see their hero be denied the ability to see him because we're back in the arena, which is a much smaller venue.
What is going to be done for those folks? I mean, people had to jump through some hoops to get those tickets.
Yeah, and I tell you, you wonder what happened in terms of their hotels and et cetera. I think for many of them, they're going to find a place to be right near here, maybe right outside, watching it on big screens, mm-hmm. watching in restaurants and pubs and yeah. I think in their hotel rooms even, or in their hotels. I think being here, being proximate to this man of history, to being proximate to the history that this convention has conveyed, that's taken place, and I think the writing of or the anticipation of the history that will be made when the president is reelected.
I'm curious about your thoughts on if President Obama is elected and if the Republicans continue to hold the House of Representatives, which yeah. you're a member of,
mm-hmm.
How's that going to work?
Well, I believe the president will be reelected. I don't think that's, to me, there's no question.
Mm-hmm.
The other party, I've been saying that they have no vision. We're the party of vision. The reality is I'm wrong. They have vision. The problem is their vision is a 19th century vision. You know, they're appealing to young voters by selecting Paul Ryan as the vice presidential candidate. It doesn't matter how young they are, their ideas are old. And the reality is that it's this president who's looking out for the average working American. I believe that we really are at a make it or break it time for the middle class in this country. And it's President Obama's agenda moving forward to provide opportunity for all Americans to achieve success. It's about infrastructure. It is about getting people back to work. Look, I think the question as to whether or not we're better off than we were 4 years ago, I think that was a mistake on their part to ask that question.
Yeah.
The reality is 4 years ago we were on the precipice, on the edge of a cliff that if we fell off would have sunk us into a deep, deep, deep depression. Maybe greater than the one of the 1930s
yeah.
And the Great Depression. It was averted. I often say it's like my constituents are walking across a train track, and I can see a train coming, and I pull a switch that diverts the train from a mile away, mm-hmm. and the train doesn't go down that track, and they don't get hit by it, and they say, thank you for what? What did you do for me? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that's where the president is in right now. Are we where we want to be? No. But we're in the right direction. We're moving in the right direction. We're creating more and more jobs. We need a Congress, and it comes to your point, your question. We need a Congress that will cooperate. We need to work with, to, you know, the compromise, the big, bad, ugly C word, but to really do what's in the best interest of this country. It's no longer about getting rid of the president. You know, that Mitch McConnell said that their focus is to see this president unelected. That will have been unaccomplished. He will be reelected. The first 2 years of his last term are going to be his strongest. And I think if the Republican Party does not cooperate or work with the president, that they will pay a political price for it in the midterm elections.
Yeah, as happened, you know, when Harry Truman called out the Republican Party for the Do Nothing Congress of, right. of 1948, mm-hmm. Republicans didn't hold the House of Representatives again for over 40 years.
Yep, I think that I agree with you. I think they're on that. They're on that path, and it's not getting better for that party. It's getting even more and more dogmatic.
Yeah, yeah, it's got to be a tough one. Yeah. Grover Norquist told the Financial Times earlier in the week, or perhaps it was late last week, that if the Republicans took the White House and held the House and got the Senate, that to avoid Democratic filibusters, to avoid the problem that President Obama has experienced, they would take every piece of legislation, even social legislation, legislation that has to do with gay marriage or prohibiting it, legislation that has to do with gun permits or anything. They would figure out a way to put a monetary piece to it so they could call it budget legislation and push it through via reconciliation, right. So it could not be filibustered. Are there, and this, you know, he said that this is something that, you know, he had been told by senior Republican strategists they already have figured out, they already plan on doing if they win, that they're not going to have, you know, they're not going to be, you know, stopped by filibusters the way that President Obama was stopped by filibusters. Do you see any strategic, legislative strategic strategy, you know, techniques or anything like that that might be available to the Democrats if the president takes the White House and doesn't take the House, or if he does take the House, you know, is this a strategy that Democrats should be employed?
Well, I have to tell you, I do think I have a great deal of fear of the setbacks that will potentially take place if they do take control of the Senate. I have no question in my mind that they're already scheming out, if that happens, how they actually get around the 60-vote rule. You know, something that many of us have had problems with because we can't get a simple majority when we've had the majority in the Senate. When they take over, if they take over the Senate, they want to have that option for themselves. And if they can't get it, they'll figure it away by using the budgetary rules to call for a 50-plus-1 vote. I think it really goes, Tom, more to my concern about people who say, well, you know, women's rights really aren't an issue in this election. They're not going to go backwards. They're not going to undo Roe. They're not going to make contraception unavailable. I mean, they're doing everything right now they can when they don't control the Senate to make that a reality. So if anyone is delusional in this election thinking that that's not at stake, they're wrong. It is very much so at stake. A lot of these social issues are. I think that we as Democrats have to convince many of those who still have considerable Democratic districts, some that Barack Obama and even John Kerry won, that they're sitting in today, that we are watching every move that they make. And aside from that, we have to stay together and cohesive as a party as well. I think that'll be our strategy.
Yeah, the grow a backbone suggestion from one of the speakers day before yesterday was from the... the governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
You know, Democrats need to grow a background. Grow a spine. There we go.
That's right.
And you have one. Congressman Joe Crowley, you've been doing a great job for New York State. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, Sister Simone Campbell of Nuns on the Bus, live from Charlotte.
I want to nominate a man who's cool on the outside. But who burns for America on the inside.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Sister Simone Campbell of Nuns on the Bus, nunsonthebus.com, on the line with us live from the DNC. Sister Campbell, welcome.
Oh, glad to be with you.
I have to tell you, I watched your presentation, was it yesterday?
Yep.
Yeah.
Last night.
I'm sorry, I'm totally losing time. I mean,
it's hard to keep track.
It is totally gone. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant, your presentation of the DNC. It was absolutely brilliant about the essence of the morality of, you know, Catholic morality not being reflected by Paul Ryan's budget and by the Republican agenda. And clearly being reflected by the values that are there in the DNC to a large extent. Let me let you riff on that rather than me. This is your topic.
Well, it was totally an honor last night to be able to speak to the DNC about the people that we met on the bus.
and to bring them into this room. I mean, so often the delegates can get so involved in the, you know, the nitty-gritty of politics, but I think it's really important that we remember that it's folks at the margins of our society that are suffering the most, folks who can't put food on the table because either they've lost their jobs or hours have been cut back. Margaret was one of the most heartbreaking stories for me because she died because she didn't have access to health care after she lost her job. I mean, it's these folks that we need to remember when we talk policy. It's not just some academic exercise that gets scored by the Congressional Budget Office or just party gain, but it's really about lifting up our nation, being we the people, the 100%, and that's who I was able to speak for last night. What an honor. What an amazing experience it's been.
I have a friend who's a very active Catholic and also and a very active Democrat and also pro-life.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of a middle position, but it seems like I look at the Supreme Court. We have five Catholics on the Supreme Court. They are the hard right-wingers.
Not all of them.
You've got the Paul Ryans of the world. There are a lot of Catholics who are just taking these many of them in the media who are taking these very hard right-wing positions, you know, the Pat Buchanans of the world. And then there are there's traditionally been the social progressive Catholics, from Father Berrigan, going back thousands of years.
And, right to Jesus.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, the first liberal. And I'm just curious if you could illuminate those of us. I was not raised Catholic. I'm not Catholic, so I see it from this. I was raised a Methodist. I see it from the outside, not the inside. What is the schism or the battle? What is the nature of that difference between those different types of Catholics, politically and socially?
I think that's a really important question, and I think one of the differences is it seems to go to the issue of wealth, how wealthy folks are, and the wealthier folks get, the more established they are, they have a tendency to think that they can take care of themselves, and they lose that the gospel is about Jesus saying that we're community, that we're in this together, where two or three are gathered, that's where Christ is. And I think another thing is that as you get more wealthy, you have a tendency not to experience what it is to struggle every day and to have a question about, can you keep a roof over your family's head, or can you really take care of each other? But the other piece that I think is so critical is that we in our nation have started just yelling at each other and calling that political discourse. And the one of the women I talked about last night was a middle-class woman, maybe upper middle-class, I don't know, in her 30s, who asked us for people that she could talk to, names of people she could talk to, because the anger, the yelling that is masquerading as political values is really undermining the democracy of our nation. And so I think there's a lot of ways where the political game has become more important than solving our political problems. And what I'm trying to do is, what we at Network, our organization, are trying to do, is to lift up the fact that the 100% needs us to come together to speak about values. I am pro-life, but there's a whole lot more to life than just the issues of abortion and euthanasia. So we've got to be able to talk to each other, though. Let's have a sane conversation about these issues. Let's not just yell. That's what we're about.
Yeah. And so you think that as people become more affluent, they tend to become harder, as it were, on social issues?
Yeah, I do, because I think that it's harder and harder for them to have experiences of the real-life struggles.
Yeah, especially if they're multi-generationally affluent.
Absolutely. And what we saw on the bus, I expected that on the bus trip, which we did to, you know, nine states, was to experience in low-income communities that it would be hard for people to come together, that would be the place we'd experience pain. But you know what I found? In the low-income community, we found beauty, we found support, we found that sisters create relationships, create community. But it was in the middle class and upper middle class communities that we found loneliness, fear, isolation, and a real hunger to try to communicate. Those are the folks we're trying to speak to. We can be in this together. The love of God spills out all over, and that's what Catholic sisters do, is share that love. So I'm trying to share the love around.
Good on you. That is marvelous. Nunsonthebus.com. We're talking with Sister Simone Campbell, Nuns on the Bus, who spoke to the DNC last night about this trip across the United States. Was it eight cities?
Oh, no, 32 cities.
32
nine,
cities.
Nine states, 2,700 miles.
Oh, wow.
I know. That was a big
one. That's all. That's a big... And are you continuing?
What's happening is it's catching fire. And we've got a group that's doing it in Missouri. We have a group that's doing it in New York State. We have another group.
Other groups of nuns?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. We've developed a protocol for if you want to be a nun on the bus. And we've developed magnets that go on your car door, which uh-huh. has the design of the bus. And so anyone that signs up for our five little rules of the road, you have to have a nun, you have to speak civilly, you have to be about the poor, and especially the expansion of Medicaid and the pushback against the Ryan budget. And on our website, you can see it. And if you want to join us as nuns on the bus, you have to have at least one nun with you. So, but we're going to do the New York people on September 24th, I understand, are going to do nuns on the ferry, on the Staten Island ferry, because what wow. we realize is that the Ryan budget is in Never Never Land.
Yeah. Yeah, it is fundamentally, well, it's nothing that Jesus would recognize, let's just say that.
Absolutely, he'd be shocked.
Yes. Sister Campbell, thank you so much for the extraordinary work that you're doing. You're changing the world. You're genuinely doing God's work. Thank you very much.
It's a gift of the Spirit. Thank you so much.
Thank you. NunsOnTheBus.com. Check it out. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Guests from Charlotte, your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day. Say it again. Oh, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse is going to be with us coming up. Stick around. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, nah, I don't think so, not a chance. Senator Sherrod Brown on the line with us, a U.S. Senator from Ohio. His website, brown.senate.gov, and, of course, sherrodbrown.com. Senator Brown, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back. Thanks. Good progressive radio. Thanks for what you guys do.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your kind words. I'm curious your thoughts on what's going on at the DNC and what happened with the RNC last week.
Well, I think that there's so many contrasts you make. First of all, look at the crowd. There was some talk that I heard a reporter tell me that during the Republican convention that Fox had special instructions, the Fox camera people, to make sure any minorities that were in the audience, they captured them in as many live people shots as they could so they could show some sort of faux diversity. But you look at our crowd at the convention when Bill Clinton was speaking last night, or when Michelle Obama spoke, who wrote her own speech, as Bill Clinton, I think, did, and how the passion and the facts and the charisma and mostly just the honesty. And then you look at the crowds, and the reaction was really something. And, you know, they play to the Democratic Convention, they play to what they inspire. They play to people's angel side rather than playing to the lowest common denominator and too often playing to hate. And that really is the difference between the two parties. We want to uplift people, and they want to bring them to the lowest common denominator. That's why I'm proud I'm on the right side on all these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And you are facing a serious challenge in the state of Ohio as a result of Citizens United. You have the billionaires trying to whack you down.
Yeah, you know, this would we were thinking about this the other day, that some people were saying to me, you know, if it weren't for the outside groups, this would not even be an election. It wouldn't even be a race I'd have that. You know, I don't know what I'd have a 15, 20-point lead, but they are now spending $1.5 million a week. It's all orchestrated, we think.
A week?
A week. It's undisclosed money. We figure it's up to now $16 million, plus the NRA's now in and doing mail. It's radio, it's billboards, and it's almost $16 million in TV alone. And it's, you know, a lot of it's not true. It's we think it's Wall Street money because of my legislation to break up the six largest banks. We think it's likely drug company money because of my opposition to what some of the drug companies have done to consumers. We think it might be Chinese money because my legislation to level the playing field on currency with the Chinese. And, you know, we think it's oil company money because of how I've stood up on fighting against these tax breaks that the oil industry has. So no surprise that when you're outspoken progressive in a big state, you're a target. But in the end, they're wasting their money, and that's what we all recognize.
Yeah, well, and people can learn more about what they can do and how they can participate at SherrodBrown.com. And of course, your official website, brown.senate.gov.
Yeah, thank you for that, because in the end, it really is... fighting back. We're taking on Citizens United, as some of my colleagues are, and as you said, if you go to SherrodBrown.com and sign our petition and help us out, it really is we're, the only way to get rid of Citizens United, the only way to get rid of this big money is a grassroots effort like this country's never seen. And increasing numbers of people, it's not just progressives, but so many people realize that the drug companies, the insurance companies, Wall Street, the oil companies, the outsourcers, they have too much power in our government, too much lobbying power, too much campaign finance power. And, you know, we got to fight back as progressives and as community organizers and as people who care about putting this country in the right direction.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. The amendment to end or to change the to allow 18-year-olds to vote, the 26th Amendment, it was proposed on March 23rd of 1971 and ratified on July 1st of 1971. That's March, April, May, June, July. That's less than 4 months. It's 3.5 months it took from the time it was proposed in the House and Senate until it was actually ratified. My recollection of that time is that, you know, of course, the Vietnam War was going on, and there was that song, Eve of Destruction, and that iconic line in it, you're old enough to kill, but not for voting. And I genuinely think that song helped make that, amendment to the Constitution happen. But we have seen in the United States, I mean, that's one example. The other one is the end of Prohibition, which, you know, similarly went through very, very rapidly. Where when there is a groundswell, when you have an energized populace, when people get it and they're upset or they're hopeful, they're aspirational or they're upset, one or the other or both, you can make things happen that typically are really difficult. There's been 29,000 plus amendments to the Constitution proposed since this republic was founded. And there's only been 7, 8, something like that, that have actually been adapted. But on your website at SherrodBrown.com, you have a constitutional amendment that people can sign up for or, you know, sign in to endorse. I believe that this is the time and that it could actually be done. I'm curious how possible you believe it is.
Well, I appreciate the Barry McGuire Eve of Destruction citation because they also said in that song, too many senators won't pass legislation.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, if you remember that.
I do.
It was quite a song. And I think it's going to take huge pressure because we haven't passed the Disclose Act because Republicans filibustered. I believe every Democrat voted for it. But I think that every month the public gets sicker and sicker of these ads and the negative ads. And I'm starting to find people in Ohio saying, who are these people running these ads and why do they want to spend so much money to get rid of Sherrod Brown?
Right.
And I think that question, I think that's happening in places like Montana. Why do these people want to get rid of John Tester? Why do these people want to get rid of, why do these people want to beat Tammy Baldwin? Or why do these people, I think that question's in people's minds. And when you hear what you said, I had forgotten, I think I knew back then, maybe not, how quickly the 18-year-old vote passed. And times were certainly contentious because of Vietnam, as you said. But I think that songs like the Eve of Destruction, but just the whole thought, you're old enough to kill, but not old enough to vote. That how can you send somebody off to war when they can't even vote? You got a bunch of old men, old white men, sending these kids off to war.
Right, and that was a powerful...
Anonymous, yeah, at least you knew who they were. You got a bunch of anonymous billionaires trying to buy our election system. And we need to really distill how people think about that. So as people come on to SherrodBrown.com, give us your thoughts about message and how we do this. Because this really, when I see what they're doing in my state, they spent $16 million against me. Forget about that for a second. But they're also going after voting rights. It's something that there is consensus about voting rights in this country. Only the most racist people wanted to roll them back. Now it's Republican standard doctrine to try to roll back voting rights, and it's about as shameful as anything in politics. But they try to buy the elections on the top and try to go after voting rights at the grassroots.
Yeah. Have you heard the?
We got to push back.
You ever heard the Paul Weyrich clip? Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
Let me tell you about this. Paul Weyrich in 1980. He worked on both Bush campaigns. He worked on the Reagan campaign
right,
in 1980.
Right, who he is, yeah.
You know who he is. Okay, he was, he was Ronald Reagan's direct mail guy and an icon in the Republican Party. This is 25 seconds here. This is Paul Weyrich speaking in a church in Dallas, Texas in 1980 to a group of Christian conservative Republican activists who were about to go out and do poll challenging. Here he is.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down. And by the way, Paul Weyrich was the founder of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council,
right.
which is behind these laws.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's so
yeah,
obvious.
It's really, yeah, there, as I said earlier, is you know, a small group of racists would try to do things to suppress the vote. But it's Republican Party doctrine now, and it's coming from the top. As you point out with ALEC, that it's state after state after state going after voting rights, going after taking time away from early vote, restricting early voting, requiring IDs, all aimed at low-income voters, always aimed at suppressing the vote among low-income voters, always.
Yes, and students and the elderly and the disabled and people who find it hard to get a driver's license or don't need one or can't afford a car. Basically the Democratic constituency. These voter suppression ID laws are pure and simple. It's all about suppressing the vote. And it is the strategy that Paul Weyrich laid out in 1980, and they're playing it so well.
So
Senator Sherrod Brown, we have a minute left. I'm curious, beyond going to sherrodbrown.com and sharing thoughts with you on these things and on this constitutional amendment and whatnot. What else would you recommend that our viewers and listeners be doing now?
Well, I think just making that contrast between where we want to take the country on, particularly on what they're going to do with the budget. I mean, they want to do more tax cuts for the rich, and almost by definition, that means cutting Medicare, it means cutting Pell Grants, it means cutting Head Start. It's going after young poor kids. It's going after middle class. People that aspire to go to college, middle-class families, and it's going against the elderly with putting them out there with a coupon book to buy vouchers or coupons and trying to figure out how you buy insurance with this coupon book. And it's pretty clear to me that this is really an assault on the middle class and an assault on people that want to join the middle class.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. This is the core of the Romney-Ryan budget plan. No question about it. Sherrod Brown, sherrodbrown.com. Senator Sherrod Brown, thank you so much for being with us today, sir.
Always, Tom. We'll do it again. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure having you on. Anytime. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, a fellow who may know something about Mitt Romney, the Lieutenant Governor of the great state of Massachusetts, Timothy Murray. Stick around.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting live on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base on Earth, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable TV systems across the country on Free Speech TV. Timothy Murray, the Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts, is on the line with us to speak on behalf of the Barack Obama campaign, barackobama.com. Timothy P. Murray, Mr. Murray, or Governor, Lieutenant, what is the correct address for a Lieutenant Governor, sir?
Well, it all depends on where we are and whether we're the governor or not. I guess it's governor when we are not in the presence of the governor. When the governor, we are in the presence of the governor, it's Lieutenant Governor. But you can call me Tim.
Okay. All right. Or Mr. Murray Governor Murray. I should know this stuff. My wife's father was the Assistant Attorney General for the state of Michigan for decades. And we got very involved in all that stuff. But anyhow, that was long ago and far away. So tell me, you probably, I'm guessing, know something about Mitt Romney. He was the governor of your state.
I do. Before I was lieutenant governor, I was the mayor of Worcester, Massachusetts, which is the second largest city in New England. And during that time, Governor Romney was in office. And fact, one of the reasons that I ran for lieutenant governor was to try to combat, you know, what many local officials, mayors across Massachusetts have been facing under Governor Romney. You know, really literally no ability to kind of talk and interact and problem solve with him and his administration. And one of the mayors in Massachusetts said that I worked with at the time, this guy thinks we work for him. I think that reflects a corporate mentality that he came out of, rather than a collaborative, how do we solve problems that help the different regions of the state.
Yeah, what are your thoughts about the difference in policy and position, speaking as the former mayor of Worcester, which is a great town, by the way. I've done a couple of book signings there over the years.
Great city. Oftentimes in the shadow of Boston, but a great city.
It really is.
College students, an innovative economy. But, you know, to answer your question, let me just say first, I think Mitt Romney is a good person. There's no doubt in my mind from what I have heard about him, a real genuine family man. But I got to say, I don't think there's any political, philosophical core or value system that guides him. From all of his different flip-flop positions on both fiscal issues and or, you know, social issues, you know, I think political calculations are about, you know, what's going to get me to the next level and, you know, how can I win the seat and say what people want to hear, whether it be when he was running against Ted Kennedy, pro-choice and pro-supportive of GLBT issues. He was, that changed when he decided to run for president halfway through his term as governor. So, you know, I think whatever really the issue is, he's absolutely willing, with little qualms, to change his position.
Yeah.
So
this is a guy who just wets his finger and lifts it to the wind to decide what positions he's going to hold.
Yeah, and I think the other issue is because he, you know, grew up, his dad, corporate CEO of American Motors, and the way his own experience, he tried to govern as if it's a business. Now, let me just say that there are a lot of things that government can learn from business in terms of being more efficient and utilizing technology and, you know, always trying to measure success or goals and objectives. Mm-hmm. But government, you know, isn't business. Leaders need to listen. They need to learn. They need to engage with the people that they're leading and to solve problems, to work with other people in government, to work with local leaders. And he's just not that type of individual in terms of collaborating and problem solving. And I think that is the critical piece of being a successful leader. And he was governor here for 4 years. And basically for the last 2 years, he was running for president. So he really wasn't around. So I can't say, other than the health care law, that he was actively engaged in a major issue and saw it through to completion, other than the healthcare issue.
Right, which he's now running away from as fast as he can. So contrast that with President Obama.
Well, there are cabinet secretaries in President Obama's administration, you know, that I think are more intimately familiar with some of the key issues, whether it be transportation or regional economic development in Massachusetts, than the governor was. You know, we had Secretary LaHood in Massachusetts outside of Boston several times in the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's a former Republican from Illinois.
He still is a Republican.
Yeah, right. Former member of Congress and Republican. Yep. Talking about the need for transportation investment and how that has traditionally been a bipartisan issue. We've had Sean Donovan, the HUD secretary, recently. Endless visits from various cabinet secretaries and leaders engaging with mayors, engaging with local officials, engaging with governors and regional business leaders and chambers to try to, help. You know, government, there's so much of the debate, Tom, these days, especially from the other side, tries to make government look bad. And there's some on our side that want to make the private sector look bad. But anything that I've learned in my, nearly 6 years as lieutenant governors, 5 years as mayor of Worcester, and 4 years in the city council before that, you get meaningful things done for your community or state when it's the public and private sector working together.
Mm-hmm.
Strategic investments by government that help kind of leverage private sector strengths. And that's what the president understands fundamentally. And each and every day, you see an engaged president and his cabinet trying to come up with solutions and give businesses and partners in government the tools to make our community stronger and better.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Timothy Murray, the Lieutenant Governor of the great state of Massachusetts, BarackObama.com, the website. Lieutenant Governor Murray, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, if it's Friday, it means it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be here taking on the important issues of the day and taking your calls for a full hour, plus anything goes on Town Hall Friday. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, occupy something. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.